Untwisting the Pretzel, next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
I love pretzels, but not when they're in the law.
Yeah, because usually they're really hard and crumbly, and there's way too much salt on them when they're in the law.
I'm more worried about them being so twisted.
Well, yes, they get a very twisty, too. If you like extra twists in your pretzels, well, you're going to love this show today. Of course, then again, we're going to untwist that. So we were talking on yesterday's program about the Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in New York State, who issued a ruling in a 2-1 decision, basically saying that the Federal Defense of Marriage Act was unconstitutional and using what we consider to be some very twisted pretzel logic in order to get there.
Very twisted. So twisted that it's almost, well, this is starting to look like a mountain road. You can see the road and then it disappears and then it reappears and then it disappears and then it reappears and then it disappears. Well, there's a lot going on there and you might have to drive 10 or 12 miles to drive 1 mile up a hill. And that's what's going on here. We're driving all over the place. We've got judges making absurd statements regarding federalism. And you were in the middle of that when we ended our discussion yesterday due to time.
Right.
And I'd like you to go back over that because we want to discuss why that's pretzel logic.
Well, sure. Okay, well, what I was saying yesterday about the decision was majority opinion written by Judge Dennis Jacobs of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, he said, and I quote, that the law was, quote, an unprecedented breach of longstanding deference to federalism. Now, Chuck, I know in my dictionary, deference means you bow to it, you let it go, and the whole concept of federalism is that we look at the 10th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which says that if it's not specifically enumerated in the Constitution and reserved to the federal government or specifically prohibited to the states in Article 1, then it is by default left to the states or to the people to determine. Now, in many of our states, the issue of how you define marriage has been left to the states or to the people. Now, in Ohio, we've done it both ways. We have had a law, a state statute for defending marriage that was put on the books by our state legislators. But after the Massachusetts ruling under Governor Romney, which legalized, and I use that term loosely, legalized homosexual marriages in Massachusetts, Ohio felt that they needed to have something even stronger to make sure that it's, without any doubt whatsoever, a strong public policy opposing the idea of same-sex marriage. And so, therefore, voters put an amendment to the Ohio Constitution to defend marriage as one man and one woman. So, in Ohio, we've done this both by statute, by the state, and by the people. But according to this definition in the Second Circuit majority decision, that having a Federal Defense of Marriage Act, which we explained yesterday, also has a provision in it, part of the law that says that if a state has a strong public policy against recognizing homosexual marriage, then they will not be forced to by the extension of the Article 4 Full Faith and Credit Clause in the United States Constitution.
And here's what's wrong with that, Barry. Fact is, first of all, marriage comes predefined.
Yes.
So what's going on here is that this goofy ruling that somehow DOMA violates federalism, what he's really saying is that one state should be allowed to change the public policy of the other 49.
That's exactly what they're getting at, Chuck.
And, of course, that is not the spirit of federalism at all. The spirit of federalism is the idea that except in very specific areas, and remember the three-letter identifier that we use, DDT.
That's right.
Defense, diplomacy,
and trade.
That means that each and every state has the right to set its own policies in these areas. They have the right. For instance, constitutionally, they have the right to set the criteria for citizenship of that particular state. They have the right to decide if the state of Massachusetts wants to redefine marriage, that's fine. But Ohio does not have to accept that. If the state of Massachusetts wants to open its borders and allow everybody in the place in and give them Massachusetts citizenship, well, that's the right of Massachusetts to do. But Ohio does not necessarily have to accept that criteria. That's the idea behind federalism, not this idea that one state can come up with this rather strange idea and force it down the throats of the other 49 states. If that were true, we'd be doing a lot of things in Ohio that California is doing, that California is committing cultural suicide with.
Yes. Well, Chuck, I want to ask a question for our listeners to think about, and we'll answer it here. But the plaintiff in the case, this Edith Windsor, once the decision was announced, obviously went in front of the media and stated, and I quote, from the article that we're catching this from, which was on Yahoo News, written by Terry Baines, called Appeals Court Rules Against Defense of Marriage Act, that Windsor specifically stated, quote, this law violated the fundamental American principle of fairness that we all cherish. Charles? Can you please show me where in the United States Constitution, which is where the foundation of our laws reside, that the idea of fairness is in there?
Well, the idea of fairness isn't anything. Now, this idea that somehow, again, it's unfair to allow a state to redefine marriage, the fact is that homosexuals have the same right to marry that heterosexuals do. The only difference is that both those groups are forced to marry, if they want to marry, someone who is within a limited set of guidelines. In other words, they have to be a member of the opposite sex. They have to be a member of the human species. They have to be someone who is not closer than, depending on the state, second cousin usually.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So there are a number of restrictive criteria. And as we kind of explained yesterday, if I decide I'd like to marry my first cousin, and I say it's not fair that I can't marry my first cousin, I'm sorry, but it still remains unfair because that is a restricted idea. If I decide I want to marry my sister, if I decide I want to marry the dog, if I decide I love my horse, there have been literal cases where people actually sued in an attempt to be able to marry their horse.
Yes, and we've heard of even stranger cases at times, too, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So you can come up with all kinds of scenarios. But the fact is that there have been traditionally, and for good reason, restrictions on the right to marry who you can marry. Now, all you're doing is removing one of those restrictions. Now, what effect will that have? Well, the fact is that the state recognizes the marriage between man and woman precisely because it is good for society.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it yields children.
Yeah, and that was one of the arguments that the attorneys who were actually representing members of Congress, Chuck, because if you remember, the Obama administration directed the Justice Department not to enforce or defend the Defense of Marriage Act, even though that's one of the basic things under the Constitution that the executive branch is supposed to do, is to uphold and defend the Constitution and the laws made pursuant thereof. So a number of members of Congress had to come together, and they hired an attorney by the name of Paul Clement. And part of their argument in the case was that not only did having the law maintain the uniform definition of marriage, which is already predefined in God's Word, but it also served the government's interest of saving money, and that it helped encourage procreation.
Exactly. That is the only reason why that you recognize this contract between man and woman is because, now, sure, there are people who are beyond the age of procreation who get married. And again, that is good for society because it maintains a standard. It used to be up until the 1960s and 70s that you could not cohabit in most states. In other words, you couldn't simply decide to take up residence together. Now, you could claim to be husband and wife. And I always thought this was a mistake. Ohio outlawed common law marriage.
Yes, they did.
Personally, I always thought that was a mistake. Because I said, okay, these people are claiming to be husband and wife. They're living together as husband and wife. Why not give the wife the legal protection that someone who was married in a civil ceremony gets? Because what they did was they basically said, no, neither one of you needs any of the protection of law for claiming to be married for this certain amount of time. I think it used to be 7 years if you cohabited, took the same name, and lived together as husband and wife. You were legally husband and wife.
Yes, that's correct.
And what it did was it said that no, neither spouse has the protection of law after living together as husband and wife for some time. So what it actually did was, one, let's put it this way, it's generally bad for the woman.
That's true.
Once she ages to a certain point and becomes, quote unquote, maybe useless in his eyes, she can be chucked and she has no legal rights because if they had lived together as husband and wife, at least she could sue him for some kind of support. I never had a problem with that. I didn't like the idea of people cohabiting, but if you're going to do it, this is an old-time common law, hence the name common law marriage. It comes over from the common law, the English common law, like so much of our law that came into the United States, and it protected the spouse. It was actually a protection for them. They could be considered husband and wife by living together for a certain amount of time, and especially if they had children. Now, we took that away, and then all of a sudden decided to do a number of other things in its place that I don't think are particularly satisfactory. But that being said, we have brick by brick been tearing down the idea that somehow a married couple has more special protection than two people living together. This idea that people living together should also have these domestic partnerships available to them. Well, that's not the point. The point is that one man, one woman for life is good for society, and several men, several women for 2 or 3 years at a time with children with multiple sets of parents is not good for society, as we're seeing in our society. So why are we sitting here watching as these protections are dismantled?
Charles, I think a big part of it is that people feel somewhat helpless, especially when they've been indoctrinated into the idea that we have a supreme court, and that everything that the court hands down is binding upon everybody everywhere in the country, instead of the truth, which is the fact that just like any other court, the decision is only binding between the parties in the case. Just like Roe v. Wade is not the law of the land, neither would be defending traditional one-man, one-woman marriage unconstitutional be any more truly legally the law of the land. Now, I want to bring up a quick point here, Chuck, and I want us to think about something. There are a couple other states that have also ruled against the law, California and Connecticut, both of whom California overturned Proposition 8, which was the voters saying defending one-man, one-woman marriage. Connecticut has, I believe, passed a homosexual marriage law in their state. But here we are in New York, and we're here in New York. I believe that there's a connection, Chuck, because one of the friend of the court briefs came from the city mayor, Michael Bloomberg, who himself a Republican, and the state attorney general, Eric Schneiderman. They filed a friend of the court brief, and I find this interesting, Chuck, because if you remember on an earlier program, we talked about a man by the name of Paul Singer, who happens to be a multi-billionaire hedge fund manager who has spent a lot of money and effort in trying to push New York into approving same-sex marriages because he has a son who's homosexual. This is also the man who is the largest major donor to Mitt Romney, to Paul Ryan, individually, each of them, and to the campaign, who's given $1 million to the RNC, and over the last, I believe, 8 or 10 years, has given over $10 million to gay rights causes. It's interesting that a Republican mayor in New York City is the one filing a friend of the court brief saying, well, we believe this law, which protects federalism, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, let's not forget that, is unconstitutional and a breach of longstanding deference to federalism. Now, I found it very interesting, Chuck, that one of the key arguments, they acknowledged that it was a fair point, the majority did, but basically they avoided the point that same-sex marriage is unknown to history or tradition, because the folks who brought up from Paul Clement and the members of Congress, they made one of the legal arguments that, hey, you can't find this in history. You know, you can't. There's no precedent here that you could lean on to say that this is good for a culture or good for society.
Well, yeah. And you know what? That's a secondary argument anyway.
It is.
Because the primary argument is that God forbids it.
And that's exactly right. However, God often is not welcomed in a United States Circuit courtroom. As a matter of fact, Judge Jacobs specifically stated that maybe not specifically directly stated, but indirectly stated it by saying that law, either federal or state, is not concerned with holy matrimony. For that, the pair must go next door, he said. In other words, he's saying, well, we're going to separate church and state here. We're not talking about marriage. We're just talking about discrimination against a class of people. However, that discrimination includes we're going to force you to recognize and marry them.
Yes. Well, we're running short on time again, but just to make it clear, I'm going to make a quick point.
Sure.
If you think you're going to get decent judges out of moderate Republican candidates, viz. Mitt Romney, this judge who made this decision, wrote this decision, was a George H.W. Bush appointee.
Yes.
Surprise! So much for making sure we elect Republicans so we get conservative judges.
Well, I think, and just real quick, The district court, which also found this unconstitutional, was written by another George H.W. Bush Republican appointee, Judge Michael Balfour. So here we've got two strikes against these conservative appointees.
And that being said, we're out of time. Join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.